Hello, welcome to another episode of Unpacking Neuroqueerness. This is your host, George Muniz-Gund. Today, I have another special guest on the podcast, Jeff Fried. Jeff is an autistic senior, a late diagnosed autistic and ADHD senior. We met recently on a during a local autism support group, an online support group, and I invited Jeff to come on the podcast to talk a little bit about his experiences, and I'm going to be asking him a few questions. Without further ado, welcome Jeff.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you, George. It was a wonderful happenstance that we met at the autism group, and I'm looking forward to this. I've never been on a blog, and I can't remember anything like this in my life. So this will be interesting.
Nice. Yeah, thanks. It's a pleasure having you on. And so the first question I wanted to ask you today is when was the first time you noticed you were different? And also, well, let's just start with that. When was the first time you noticed you were different?
To be honest, my consciousness of myself was very weak. My sense of self was very weak. Looking back at it, I'd say I noticed there were things about social situations I wished I were better able to handle, but I couldn't articulate that to other people. I just knew that people would meet me and they'd maybe hang out with me and I sound interesting, and then they didn't want to talk to me anymore. And I remember I had friends, this was the 1950s and the early 60s, my childhood, and there was, how do I say it? It was, children were like ants back then. We were just everywhere. We were in the post-war baby boom, and if you couldn't find a friend, then you go find somebody else because there's millions of us. And that logic turns out not to pay off, but that's what the logic was. So I remember, in particular, the thing that stood me apart is I couldn't stand being touched. Touching me made me feel very uncomfortable. And looking back at it and trying to understand what it was, I know that I had friends who enjoyed coming up behind me and tapping me. And I would freak out. And wow, it just brings back bad memories. It was, I mean, there was no autism that I was aware of back then in the 50s. I'm sure it was there. I'm sure there are
It just
doctors knew
wasn't,
about it.
there wasn't as much awareness for sure.
There
And
certainly wasn't as much awareness. And I also, I know my parents belonged to a generation that didn't see doctors. You saw a doctor as you were approaching death. That was the only, otherwise you don't bother to see them. And I was very sick already, and they didn't have me see a doctor. In fact, one of the things that I think reflects all of the problems was I was 11 years old and I was losing the ability to walk. And I couldn't get worse and worse. It got to the point where going up and down stairs, I would sit on the stairs, I would push myself up with my hands, and then go stair by stair. My parents took me to one doctor who said, growing pains. That was it. That was the entire conversation. And I went home. And I remember it was May, and my parents went out to play bridge. They played bridge regularly. They were tournament bridge players. And they went out to play bridge. They came home, and I hadn't gone to bed. And they left me on the couch. I stayed on the couch. And they said, why didn't you go to bed? And I said, I can't walk. My father said, oh. And he laid me out on the couch, put a blanket on me, and went to bed. The next day, a doctor came to play bridge at my parents' house. And he said, before we play, I should take a look at your son. So he took a look at me, and he said, we have to send him to the hospital. And they said, and he listed off a bunch of diseases, all of which I was going to die from, except one. Luckily, that's the one I had. And they took me, they sent me to the hospital by myself. I was 11. And it turned out I had rheumatic fever, which was a disease that was, that happened frequently back then, more so in my father's childhood. My parents just didn't deal with doctors. They figured you either lived or you died. Yeah, seeing a doctor wouldn't change that.
Wow.
It was not the best of times.
Wow. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. I can understand that certainly, because I remembered hearing recently or reading recently about how people didn't go to the doctor very much back then, and it makes sense, like, hearing your experience, like, how that may have happened, and that must have been really frustrating to know that something was wrong with you and not get that, you know, not have it be, like, looked into or taken seriously.
A little, but surprisingly, ADD served me very well. I constantly forgot that I had problems. Yeah. And so as long as I wasn't encountering the problems, as long as I wasn't walking up and down stairs, as long as I was sitting in a chair, I didn't think about it. I just thought, well, I'm sick. I had nothing in which to gauge it against. So I'm sick, and this is what you do when you're sick. And the ADD, I just constantly forgot over and over again. I lost focus. I something else shiny came up in my mind, and that was what took my attention. Anyway.
Yeah, I relate a lot to, like, the sensory stuff. Like, I would get freaked out when people would just, like, touch me suddenly or, like, unexpectedly or in certain ways or, like, and then also just other little things, like, I noticed about myself before, long before I knew that I was autistic, was, like, sensory processing and sensory, like, overload, because I had sensitivity to lights, I had sensitivity to sounds, and then I even, like, little things, like, I mean, certain foods I couldn't eat because I just couldn't handle, and I still can't handle the texture of them. And then also, like,
yeah, my housemate doesn't understand what I say. The texture matters to me. That's what's important. Yeah. Is the texture. He's not autistic, so he's a, it's a flavor, you idiot.
It's hard, yeah, because, like, they just don't get it. It's like they. I've had it, like, with the food thing also, like, it's really hard to get them to understand, because I feel like people automatically think that I'm just being picky or that I just don't like something to not like it, but they don't understand that if I try to eat a certain food, I'll like gag, or like I literally can't handle the texture. And then even, like, I mean, that's just a big one that I discovered recent. And even after being autistic, I discovered that it's actually an autism thing, because I feel like I didn't realize that, or I didn't learn that, or no one told me initially. But then also, something I have with sand. I have, I don't know if you relate to that one too, but, like, when I get sand in between my toes on the beach or something, I would get kind of irritated by it.
Actually, I do know that one. I hated going to the beach. I love going to the beach. I love seeing Lake Erie. And it was, I love the fresh air. But God, I hated the sand.
Yeah. And I never really understood. That was just another one. Because you were talking earlier about, like, feeling certain things and not understanding, like, with socially, for example, like, feeling certain ways, or feeling, like, certain ways and not understanding, and that was a big one for me, with the sand. Like I knew that I had, like I felt that way, and I didn't understand. I thought it was just a weird thing about me that I didn't like sand, or that the sand bothered me, because I remember I would notice like that my sister, who isn't autistic, would not have that. Like she would, it would, I mean, that's just one example, but like I guess it's one example of like all these little things that we notice the people around us don't seem to experience in the same ways.
Yeah.
What were some of the things that you found that you were pretty good at, like in terms of like special interests and like things like that?
I think the things that, first of all, in school, the only thing I did well at was math. Science a little bit, but we didn't really do science, you know, in K through 12. But what little science we did, I adapted to that. I felt most comfortable with facts. I like facts. And I didn't like, as an example, people will often talk to me about, later in life, about, well, you do science, so you must have loved puzzles as a kid, because science is about puzzles. I said, no, I actually hate puzzles. I find them boring and empty. The puzzles I want to solve are things that we actually need, not things that we just make up for the fun of making up.
Yeah.
I later in life gained an appreciation for fantasizing. I should be honest. I did psychedelics.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what they'd do to me, but during the 60s, I tried acid, and I must have dropped it. Over a 3-year period, I probably dropped it once every other week.
Mm-hmm.
And it opened my mind. It changed me. Yeah. I didn't realize it then, but I started doing something I later learned to do recently, which is I learned to feel before I think. So it took me a while to figure out when someone says mm-hmm. to me, Jeff, how are you doing? They're not asking for an assessment. Well, I think my toes are fine, mm-hmm. but my hair is funny. And they're not interested in that. They're interested in a conversation opener to say, you're feeling good, feeling bad, having difficulties, and it's about how you feel, not how you think.
Yeah.
And what I learned through acid was to feel before, I learned mm-hmm. for the first time to feel before I think. And that was new. But I didn't, if you'd asked me, Jeff, what did you learn on this acid trip? I'd say, I don't know. I couldn't articulate it. It took me a long time to learn how to be introspective. There's an old saying, it's used in psychology by child psychologists. It says, children reveal before they reflect. Mm. And I did that into my 60s and 70s. It took me a long time to learn how to reflect on what was going on with me and to participate. Anyway, I'm sorry. I think I've gone on too long.
No, that's good. It's very good, and it's very interesting to hear also about your experience with psychedelics. Because I do hear from a lot of neurodivergent people, autistics, ADHD, etc., that they have it also, like, from a lot of us, it tends to be a very mind-opening experience.
Can I make a one small suggestion, just in case anyone's thinking, well, Jeff said I can do psychedelics. Jeff's not saying that, and Jeff is also going to say Jeff did them the wrong way. There was no instruction manual back there in the 60s. And people were dropping very strong doses of LSD. And while they may have been good LSD in the sense that they were chemically safe, They're like Owsley's assay was considered chemically safe. We were doing it the wrong way. What we should have been doing, and I think there are people now promulgating this viewpoint, is we should take microdoses until we reach a dose level where we just barely notice it.
Yeah.
Then we can decide for ourselves, is this where we feel comfortable? We can continue at that rate, or we can increase it or decrease it, but we're in control. Instead, we were doing large doses. I'd get slammed off the ceiling. I'd walk across. I was flying through the sky. And when I get done, if someone asked me, well, how was it? And they go, I have no idea. I battered my head against the wall. Now I know if you do it starting from the low dose and working your way up slowly to the high dose, higher doses, where you feel comfortable, then you can take that dose, live with that result for a while until you understand
I see. Yeah.
it. And I know there are some people who say you're trying to let your cognitive part of your brain control the non-cognitive part of your brain. Yes, that's what it's there for.
Yeah. I see.
That's what it's there for.
Yeah.
Anyway, enough of that. But yeah, that's. I look forward to they're now trying to get MDMA through the House or Senate, and it may be the way the psychedelics become a standardized. Some psychedelic use become standardized.
I see.
It may be. Anyway.
I wanted to ask you, what were like specifically about like socialization struggles and such? What were some of the hardest or most confusing things that you experienced early on, like in terms of like unspoken codes and norms and different ways of communication?
Well, the biggest one is because I'm gay, but I didn't know it. Like everyone who's gay, there's a time you don't know, and there's a time you do know.
Yeah.
I didn't know, and my encounters with gay people were not all that good at first because I was out of sync with the popular viewpoint of what it meant to be gay. And I couldn't discuss it with anyone because it was not cool to be gay. So, and I was still trying to formulate in my head, am I gay? Am I this? Am I Paul Lynde? You know who Paul Lynde was?
Pauline.
He was a TV comedy actor, and he was camp from beginning to end. And I kept saying, I'm not campy. Does that mean I'm not really gay? What is that anyway? And I had no. Well, it's only later in life, in my 30s, when I moved to San Francisco, and I shared a house with other gay friends, and I began to say, "Okay, we're not all Paul Lynde. We're not all camp. Maybe we're something new."
Yeah.
So. That was, but that's something I can only see in hindsight. I couldn't see it back then.
Right.
I think we take for granted popular thinking about a subject, and we think that defines it, and it didn't.
Yeah.
It didn't at all, and it was confusing for me.
Yeah, definitely. I think it happens a lot with a lot of things in society is that we're taught to view things a certain way. And it's not always the way they are. And like, we think, like, because I feel like I feel the same way about like queerness and like how there's this belief that it's like there's only one kind of being gay or being queer. And like you said, not everyone is the same. And also to autism, I feel like, there is this idea in society, or a lot of people hold the belief that autism, like autistics only, Like, a person has to have, like, only a certain combination of traits or only, like, a certain presentation to be autistic. And that's also very not true because they're, even though autistic people, like, process, have their unique ways of processing and seeing the world, every autistic person is different. So yeah, I can relate. I can relate a lot to that. Yeah.
Actually, it's funny at that moment while you were talking, and I don't want to make you self-conscious, but I'm going to tell you, you were using your hands the way I do, and I came from a town in Buffalo, New York, where I was raised, and certain European groups used their hands, others didn't. I came from one that used their hands, and I feel comfortable with people who use their hands. I later found out a friend of mine when I lived in San Diego said, "You should watch out how much you use your hands. You're making people feel uncomfortable." I said, "What? How can you make someone feel uncomfortable with passion?"
Yeah.
That's how.
No, I know. Yeah, no, I can I wow, that's cool. And that's I mean that's cool about like the that reminded you of that and it's I think it's also just an example of how like in like because like as a form of stimming like how that's one of the things 'cause it's interesting like my sister I had this other stim, like I did the thing with my hands, and then I had this other one where I would come when I would get really happy or really excited about something, I would like grab my chin, and my sister never understood that, and I think it made her uncomfortable, and I remember growing up, and now she understands, and she'll like. She like looks back on it and she realizes now, but it's just funny because she would always give me a hard time for doing that. She like, you know, why do you grab your chin? Why do you do that? So, and how, yeah, because people aren't used to seeing it because it's been viewed as like something uncomfortable, but it's really like at the core of it, like when you just view it for itself, it's really an expression of joy. It can
Yeah.
be, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, what was kind of on the same topic of self-discovery and stuff, tell us a little bit about what it was like getting your ADHD diagnosis in your 40s.
That was, well, what I can remember of it, because it was a time when I wasn't remembering things, is I knew I was different, I was uncomfortable, and I wasn't socially connecting with people. And I thought it was because I easily angered, but it wasn't angry, I was passionate. And I always believed if you're not passionate, you're not alive. I didn't realize that not everybody can be this animated. They don't feel comfortable with it. But I do.
Yeah.
And I saw a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist did a simple test for, what's the word for it? For impulse control. That's where they have a computer program, and you're sitting there, and you're told to click on a certain thing that you see, and don't click when you don't see it. And because we're impulsive, we'll click when we shouldn't click.
Yeah.
And I remember him doing that, and I didn't think much of it at the time. But he said he did that, and he did some other things. And unlike autism, in autism, they're often using historical evidence. They're asking you, what did you do in these situations? How did you do that? Because as adults with autism, we've learned tricks to get around these
Yeah.
differences. And so I was 48, and he said, "You have ADD. That's pretty clear. You have impulse control." And I still didn't know what it meant. And then I tried neurofeedback. So I'm going in. I have ADD, whatever that is. I do neurofeedback. It's where they hook up wires to your head. Then you try to control the screen by how you focus the screen. And what they did was it would play movies, but it would only play the movie if you focused. And so over a period of weeks, I learned to focus, because before then I couldn't focus very well. I didn't know that. Now I know that. So then it became interesting for me, because I could do it. I was conscious of it. I was conscious of it,
yeah.
And I was conscious of the effect. I felt different. Instead of being my usual agitated self, I was calm.
Yeah.
And I rather liked that. It was nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
no.
If he had told me that, I wouldn't have understood what he's talking about. I had to. It's like you understand apple pie. You understand apples when you eat apple pie, apple coddler, learn to juggle apples, pick apples. Then you know what an apple is. But if someone describes it, it's a red fruit.
Yeah.
You don't know what it means.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. Like not knowing, like not having had an apple before or even held an apple, you don't really have, you only have a scent, like you know the term, but you wouldn't know what it is. And then I can also relate to like knowing that certain things are related to ADHD or that certain things are related to autism, and then catching those things, or like, you know, I'm like, you know, like, because in the past, like, if I were in sensory overload and I were able to catch that and identify why it was, I might have been calmer. I feel like sometimes it is really helpful to identify, like, why I'm feeling something, because I feel like, especially, like, as an autistic person, when I can't figure out what is going on and why, it makes me more distressed. So that I can definitely
sure.
see that being helpful. Yeah.
Yeah. I it also helps. And I think it's along the same line. We can talk about this a little later if you like. If you can be around other people who are autistic,
yes.
that helped me.
Absolutely.
Because then I suddenly realized I'm like them. They're not bothered by me.
Yeah.
They're not going to reject me because I'm autistic. You're a terrible person. You're autistic. Sure, I'm autistic, but you're really autistic. They're not going to do that. And that made a big difference for me. And
yeah.
being a software engineer, I ran into tons of people who were very difficult to deal with. And I was difficult to deal with. And we all had autism.
Yeah, I have read that, like in software engineering, there are likely a lot of undiagnosed autistic people. That it's like one of the fields that autistic people
draws us. It draws us.
Yeah.
The screens. I'm hypnotized by the screens and all that information coming at me. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's really what you were saying about community too is really important. It's been one of the main benefits for me also, like over the last few years, connecting more with other autistic people that experience, like see the world in similar ways and process things in similar ways. And really, it's validating. Like every time I join an autism meeting group or whatnot, or I'm just, even if I'm just talking one-on-one with other autistics, even like on my podcast or wherever, there's something very validating about the conversation, because it almost always is a lot like we're both just relating a lot to each other, and it makes us feel more understood as well. I think knowing, it's just like, because you feel like less of an outlier, like you said, it's, you're not bothering anyone around you, because we're all, you know, doing the same kind of things and like behaving in the same kind of ways. Yeah.
And I understand them, and through understanding them, or at least I feel I understand them, and through feeling I understand them, I feel they understand me.
Yeah.
It feels reciprocal.
Yeah.
I rarely do I encounter, especially in those autism group when we met. I don't know any other place where I feel as understood. I don't feel as seen as I do there.
Absolutely. Yeah. How on the same general kind of topic in terms of like socializing and such, what were your experiences like with dating over the years?
Well, first of all, I should point out, even into my 30s and 40s, I could go to a party and I would talk tech with people because I didn't know how to talk about anything else. So social connection came for me in my 60s. It had to do with really learning how to feel before I think. And in feeling my own feelings for me, I began to feel about other people. What's going on with them? And was I accurate? I stopped worrying about being accurate. I started to learn. I taught myself. I learned, however you want to say it, that it's interesting. I suddenly felt I should apologize because I'm not looking at you. I'm looking away to the right, which is what autistics do. I don't think neurotypicals understand we do this because it's less confusing. Otherwise, we'd feel obligated to respond to your movements, and then we couldn't have a conversation because we'd be changing every second. So great. I lost track of what I was talking about. Way to go.
We were just talking about,
Socialization.
yeah.
And so I had. It took me a long time to learn good socialization rules. Not the hello, how are you? Okay, I say hello, how are you back? And, not the signaling kind of crap, but actual social moves. As an example, one thing I never understood until late in life was when I had straight friends who would tell, straight neurotypical friends who would tell me, oh, he does that because he's so and so and such and such. I say, how do you know he's there? How do you know that person that way? It was such depth, because I can't do that. I'm clueless. I'm now learning how to do that, and that's a good socialization rule. But and that's one we should raise constantly with children. So when you have little children, you say, and the child says, "What about this, that, and the other?" and say, what do you think he meant by that? What do you think is going on with him that he said that? And then letting him go ahead and explain things. It doesn't matter whether they're right or wrong. It's how he sees them. And then helping that child learn how to interpret the world around him. No one did that for me. But then again, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. My father probably was autistic. And I remember my father loved acting. The reason he loved acting was because he didn't have a personality that he understood of his own. And so he learned to be other people. And he can be wonderful, likable people, he can be mean people, he can be all sorts of different people. And he felt comfortable
I
masking.
think that's why I a big part of why I got into acting also, and like because I feel like I was, I think a lot of it, I mean, obviously I always liked being able to play different characters, but I feel like a lot of that came from masking, because I had to put on this mask so often just on a day-to-day basis, and studying the behaviors of other people and the nuances and like how they perceive things, how they communicate, how people interact, and all these things and then applying those to myself, I feel like I was trying on different costumes or different characters. And I feel like even tweaking sometimes, like I would do something this way and see how it went, and then I would try a conversation another way and see how it went. So I feel like it was kind of like different characters, like of the mask. And that kind of also, like what you were when you were talking about your dad being really into acting as well, it was resonating a lot, like that feeling of like how I feel like the masking and everything made me like that, and then also other people that I've talked to, like with ADHD and autistics, have felt the same way.
We never, my father and I didn't talk a lot, and we never talked about that. But I remember he played Willie Loman, Death of a Salesman, and I suddenly realized he was a salesman. That's how he earned most of his living. He started a business manufacturing jewelry displays, and he was out selling and hawking his jewelry displays. So he got to play himself in a way. And I think it would have been an interesting conversation for us to have. I was the only one in the family who was interested in acting, but he wasn't interested in talking to me about it. Anyway, there we are.
I what were some what would you say some of are some of the main things that have changed around autism and ADHD awareness these last couple of decades?
All right, so we're starting from nothing, no awareness whatsoever. And misdiagnosis, we call it childhood schizophrenia. I think what changed for autism actually changed for all mental diseases, all mental disorders. I'm not sure I don't want to say disease, disorders. And that was, there was more of an openness to actually understanding what was going on as the road to providing a more comfortable life for the person. And that, because I remember as a kid, the popular view then was you fixed people who were looked at as problems to be solved. So your autism, I think in some ways I was better off not getting any help because it would be the wrong help. And they try to give me a list of things to remember to do. I think that we've changed. We've realized now that change comes from within and it comes from understanding. And we may have different levels of understanding, but those levels of understanding are what you have to work with. And that's where real change comes from. And it comes from respecting people, too. I mean, there's still people out there trying to fix gay people.
True. Well, it's true, and there's a lot of connection with gay conversion therapy and ABA therapy for autism, and it's the same kind of
Which one is AVA? I don't know.
ABA is applied behavior analysis, and
Oh, okay.
like it's the more well-known autism therapy out there now, and it is basically, from what I've read, they keep autistic children from stimming and force eye contact and I mean, I think there now it is changing also. I think the traditional ABA was really harmful because it punished children for like not making eye contact and stimming and so on. And I later came to discover that the same person that created ABA therapy was the person that created gay conversion therapy. So I definitely seen that strong resemblance, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm gonna have to remember that one. That's awful.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
But I'm also hopeful of how society seems to slowly be moving in a better direction, like as with both queerness and neurodiversity, with both starting to be more widely accepted and understood now, and I think particularly with autism, historically there's been a lot of stigma and in the way that people view autistic people or autistic traits. I feel like there's also, it's so unfortunate that it's a lot of times someone might not even know that the other person is autistic. I read that there's like actually a study that was done recently that a lot of people have a lot of internalized bias against like autistic behaviors. Like, so if someone meets an autistic person, but doesn't know that they're autistic, they usually have like a negative perception or a negative opinion about them. And then, like, a lot of times that changes if they learn that the person is autistic, but it just speaks to, like, how there isn't much understanding about, like, different ways of being or behaving, and how, like, the autistic way, even if a person does know, like, even in some situations, if someone does know that I'm autistic, how, like, my way of doing things, like, you know, not making eye contact or stimming is viewed as wrong and or has been viewed as wrong. And I'm glad that that's starting to shift now, yeah.
Yeah, I looking back at it, I realized there are lots of things I was doing that I had no idea where they came from. And as an example, when I was in the hospital with rheumatic fever, I was hospitalized for 2 months. I nearly died. And I was bored to tears. They had to keep me isolated because they were afraid I might have something communicable. That's how they dealt with things like that back then. And I sat around juggling my massage. They have a massage they give you because you're lying in bed so long. And they prevent bed sores. And I took the bottle and I would spin it. I would sit there for an hour or two just spinning the bottle. Because it was comforting to me.
Yeah. This is stim.
And things like, I still do this. I hold my hands, you can't see it, but I hold my hands a certain way. Because it feels comfortable.
Yeah.
And I don't know why it feels comfortable. I know that as a kid, we never fixed up our basement, but we had an old couch down there. I would go down in the basement, and I would do this. I would rock, because it was a good chair. It wasn't a rocking chair, but I could rock, and I would rock, and I would hum. And I would make up songs, and I felt very, very comfortable doing this. And I didn't tell anybody else. And I got my privacy. I knew I needed privacy. So yeah. There's some awareness I knew. This is not going to be acceptable, and my mother, not out of meanness, but I remember several times she would bring laundry down to the basement where the laundry, the washing and dryer were, and she would walk by me and I'd be humming, and rocking, and she said, "Why don't you go outside? Just go outside." They're never going to ask the question, "Is this wrong? Is this something you need help with?"
Yeah. Or like why understanding why you were doing it, right? Or like
Understanding that I had no understanding. If they could have an understanding that I had no understanding, and then realize maybe we need to talk to a professional who can give me the understanding.
Yeah.
But they didn't. They didn't. I'm reminded with the ADD that I got a late diagnosis at 68 because I couldn't focus long enough to realize I couldn't focus long enough.
Yeah.
I think my parents were worried. If you open up this Pandora's box of Jeff's rocking and the other things he does, then they're going to have lots of problems to deal with. Better you just don't open the door. How were your parents with that?
I feel like early on, they knew that I had like some neuromotor differences, and I mean, they noticed like that I had some neuromotor differences, and that I had some.
Oh, you mean like in the sense of cerebral palsy?
No, just I think more just like related to like tying knots and stuff, and just like stuff like that. Like I had to do some physical therapy and then speech therapy too. Like I had speech delays, but there wasn't, I don't think they thought it was, I don't think they realized that it was part of something bigger. It was like,
sure.
You know, because it tied into the sensory sensitivities and social sensitivities. But I think, not to blame them, you know, because there just wasn't as much understanding back then, but I think that these things were all viewed as like separate things. And I think in retrospect, I wish that all of us had more information about it, just as from a perspective, because then we would have been able to get help and support, not just about like getting help and support, because even that I feel like sometimes would be hard to like advocate for accommodations at school and stuff, but I think also because it would make us understand ourselves a lot more. And I think for every person out there that wasn't able to discover their autism or ADHD until recently, there seems to be, including myself, there's part of it that's kind of a grief of like, I want, like, if I had known sooner, I wouldn't think of myself as like a broken neurotypical, and I would just realize like, oh, okay, this is because I'm autistic, and this is related to autism, that is related to autism. And yeah, it would just give me a better picture, but I know that
there were no simple cures offered. But still the knowledge was worthwhile.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it's just the way things have evolved. Like I know that back then, it just wasn't, it wasn't as understood. Like I didn't, I don't know. It just wasn't the way things, like I'm still glad that I was able to get support for a couple different things individually, but it was just, there were other things that there wasn't much support, and they're like sensory stuff. I don't know. Like they're, I didn't understand why. And I think even just understanding why can be helpful. And,
Can I make a parallel?
Sure.
If you're dealing with ADD, the one thing you can do very, very quickly is try the meds, even if you don't ever use them beyond there, and you'll instantly feel different. And you'll know that difference. And you'll know that you can't do it on your own. It's very, very difficult. Now, there are very, very few therapies like neurofeedback where you can actually change the brain. But knowing that, you have a very solid understanding because you've eaten the apple. You've taken the pill. You say, oh, my God, I feel calm. I feel connected. I can do these things. Autism doesn't have that. Autism may have some one day, but it doesn't have it now.
Yeah, I can see that. Definitely. I think I kind of like forgot a little bit earlier, but where I was going, but now I remember what the autism, I think that's a big reason of why I didn't realize I was autistic, like, until much later, until I was 16, which is still relatively early, compared to a lot of people, but like, the social, because that was more related to the social, like, the only reason I went to get evaluated for autism was because I started struggling in school socially, or and showing a lot of burnout and exhaustion from school, and like not specifically academically, even though there were, with the ADHD, there were subjects, even though I didn't know about ADHD yet, like I can see how there were some things that were because of ADHD with certain subjects that I couldn't engage with. But what was happening a lot when I was a teenager was I had struggles socially, and on the side, like, we knew that I had a lot of subjects that I was like really into and really good to, and so I was diagnosed originally with Asperger's in 2010, which was pretty much, which is now known as autism level 1. But I feel like the main things that led to the diagnosis were the fact that I struggled in school because of the, like, particularly socially. Like, I think that was the main thing that led to that diagnosis, and I had to have the experience of struggling socially in school and then coming home, and then my parents, like, noticing those struggles over time. And I feel like, yeah, I feel like maybe I wouldn't have gotten, like, if I hadn't, if my parents hadn't decided to, like, to seek out, and if we didn't have the resources to seek out a diagnosis or an evaluation, I can see how that might have gone unnoticed even longer. And I actually forgot to ask you earlier, after I asked you about your ADHD diagnosis, I forgot to ask you about how 20 years after that you ended up getting the autism diagnosis.
That was somewhat of a fool's errand. I was seeing a psychologist. We weren't making a lot of progress doing one-on-one therapy. I didn't have a diagnosis of autism. My ADD was under control. I don't know why, but I somehow, in the conversation with my therapist, the idea of being autistic arose. And I said, well, what would it take for me to have somebody who knows what they're doing give me a diagnosis? He said, he knows a guy, and I could go to see him. So I said I'd go to see him. I ended up paying $5,000. With inflation in today's dollars, that's probably closer to $10,000. For a diagnosis, he did a full assessment, and I was diagnosed with PDD-NOS, persistent developmental disorder not otherwise specified, which is a real catch-all for, something wrong, I don't know what it is. and it's not very useful. However, because I was around people with autism, and I began to see my behaviors in them, and I saw the difference between them and neurotypicals, I saw myself better. And I said, all right, so, I mean, because really looking back at it, what they're trying to do is historically have you, the person who has potentially autism, now tell someone else how you recognize your own autism, because that's what that ends up being. And that's not really a great way to diagnose these things. That's why they don't do it. That's why a lot of doctors will and a good doctor usually will say, act as if you have, and then respond to it accordingly. But don't waste your money on a diagnosis because it won't help you. Except some people need a diagnosis in order to get help. That's part of the deal. But that, and then I was 68, which was 9 years ago. Oh my God. And it was not useful. I feel I should say this so someone listening to this understands better. There are people who have and need, who do not have, but need a diagnosis in order to get Medi-Cal or Medicaid or any one of those things. And that's a real problem because they just don't have a good way of testing for them because you've learned to mask. As you grow older, you've learned to, I don't say that. I've learned to pause and hold back. I don't let my mind just let loose with ideas because it has consequences. It's, I mean, when I learned how to feel before I think, it changed who I was as a person. And so now if I, now when I say I'm autistic, people say, well, you don't sound autistic. Tell me what it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly.
French horn, trombone. What is it?
What does it sound like? Yeah, because I feel like it came up earlier, like people have a very very narrow views of what they feel autistic people are supposed to look like or sound like, or but yeah.
Actually, can I add? One we just talked about earlier is a good one. I didn't know how to look someone in the eye when I talked with them. So I once I learned that's a problem. You're doing it, Jeff. Here's and did it non-judgmentally. They said it's part of autism. And then I watched other autistic people doing exactly the same that same thing. I went out of my way to change. I decided if I was going to connect with people, I had to see eye to eye with them. And I was willing to, I made an effort. So I changed. So I don't have that problem. Does that mean I'm not autistic? No. I'm still autistic. I'm just learning how to make the best of it. Not let it dominate my life.
I mean, I think that's another, like we also talked about, it's another important part of having community with other autistics, because then we don't have to worry so much about masking things like holding eye contact. And even though it's useful to be to be able to use the masking when we have to use it, and understand the neurotypical codes and languages, when we have to use them with neurotypicals, it's always refreshing to be able to be able to unmask with other autistics too.
And it surprises me, you know. People say, "Oh, then you can get over your autism." I use that phrase, that terrible phrasing, on purpose. When I started talking with you, I went right into the mode where I wasn't going to look at you, even though I've worked on that for years. When I don't think about it, I go right back to, "Don't look him in the eye."
Yeah, which I think is like also, it's a bummer that there's not as much on that, there's so much emphasis on eye contact out there in the world, because I feel like if it weren't one of those things that's so important to neurotypical society, I feel like we would be a lot more relaxed, because I feel like having to, it makes us like worry, you know, it creates this anxiety, like having to worry, because I'll still do it sometimes, like even with other autistics too, and then I'll remind myself, oh wait, I don't have to. But it's like, I look back and it's, yeah, I just wonder what it would have been like if I didn't have to, if it's not something that I had to worry about, or I had to be told like so many times that I wasn't making eye contact, because then, because it does create sort of like that anxiety, but it's also what makes it nice to remind ourselves when we don't have to do it.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Something that I was just thinking about when we were talking about socializing and everything, and have there been people in your life that you've become comfortable over time disclosing that you're autistic, and then have they, like, with the understanding of why you struggle with eye contact or whatnot, in kind of the similar way of how us autistics kind of understand that about each other automatically, have there been people in your life, even non-autistic, that have been able to understand that more, and have you felt less pressured to mask around them?
Well, now you make me wish I'd done things a little differently. I never pressed the issue. I to be honest, I've always felt, and wrongly so in some cases, I've always felt like an outsider, like I can't ask things of other people. And for various reasons. So as an example, I have a sister who's a PhD psychologist. It took me a long time to ever mention to her that I'm autistic. Mm. She wanted to play doctor and fix me, and I don't even think she has the skills for it. She doesn't understand. She doesn't have the skills. I'm not sure how to articulate to people that, you know. So I've told people, and I was in a different group. I was in a gay men's group, and I said, sometimes when I talk, I'm going to look away, because it's easier for me. And I think I made them uncomfortable. Mm. And I was leading the group. Mm. So that was kind of bad. It's a lot of other things. I think the problem for me is it's asking something of others. And, you know, one psychologist said, aren't I allowed to claim a little space? Mm-hmm. And that's a good question, because in truth, I don't know.
Yeah, I think it speaks to how, like, a lot of us have been societally taught to not ask for help or ask for understanding or to, like, internalize a lot of our struggles, because I certainly did that myself as well, and I'm only really starting to unpack it now. And I always enjoy talking to other autistics as well about their own experiences with all that.
Our culture is very much a you're on your own, suck it up level. Yeah. And they look at anything else as being lazy or really mean about it.
Yeah, exactly. There's very little understanding.
And because of that, very little empathy.
Yeah, and little empathy too. Which is very ironic, because we, like, autistics usually get told that we don't have empathy, but to me, a lot of times it feels like
The neurotypicals are the problem.
Once again, this was really, really great. I'll let you go now, but thanks once again for coming on.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed it. This is a good adventure. Please let me know when you post this.
I will. I'll send you the link and everything in my email.
Yeah, I will. And I have a technical question. These are bone conduction.
Bone conduction.
All right, so they're not in my ear.
Okay.
And they're very light. But I sounded okay to you.
Oh, you sounded good. Yeah, I could hear you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. And thank you, everyone, for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I'll see you all next time.